Good evening, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving. I hope you enjoyed your turkey. My name is Gordon Landau. I'm one of the co-chairmen of the program portion of the convention. And I think you will agree that if there were to be no more program the rest of the convention, after attending the session this afternoon, we would all be able to go home feeling extremely satisfied with what we've heard. We spent a fascinating afternoon studying Torah in honor of Rabbi Turkey. My name is Gordon Landau. I'm one of the co-chairmen of the program portion of the convention. And I think you will agree that if there were to be no more program the rest of the convention, after attending the session this afternoon, we would all be able to go home feeling extremely satisfied with what we've heard. We spent a fascinating afternoon studying Torah in honor of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. But before we conclude this historic tribute, we might pause for a moment to reflect on another of this century's giants, one whose story is indelibly intertwined with Rav Soloveitchik's, and I'm speaking about Rabbi Dr. Samuel Belkin. I was a student at YU, at Yeshiva University in the 1960s. It was a prime time for Dr. Belkin, as building after building arose to transform campus after campus. Yet, all the while, he continued to affirm his commitment to Torah learning and secular scholarship at the highest levels. It certainly seems that Dr. Belkin was irreplaceable, but the promise of the 60s gave way to the malaise of the 70s, and upon Dr. Belkin's death, our next speaker was called upon in 1976 to fill those gigantic shoes. He took over the direction of Yeshiva University in a time of federal cutbacks and, to put it mildly, financial turbulence. But by fusing a synthesis of lay, rabbinic, and governmental leaders, he helped the university surmount its financial crisis and ushered in a period of calm, consolidation, and then unprecedented growth. But his duties as a full-time administrator and fundraiser, like his distinguished predecessors, Dr. Belkin and Dr. Bernard Revel, did not and do not prevent him from somehow finding the time to exercise his role as one of the intellectual and spiritual leaders of Orthodox Judaism. He is the author of 6 books and numerous articles and papers. He was one of the founders of Tradition and is a longtime friend and supporter of the Orthodox movement. He is someone who does not hesitate to utilize his bully pulpit to promote Torah Lishma, Torah Umada, and general Jewish welfare. Having often had the privilege of hearing him speak and attending scores of meetings with him over the years, I can also attest to his wry sense of humor, especially his love of puns. To cite but one example, in the dedication of one of his best-known works, he states, "To my beloved parents, Samuel and Pearl Lamb, whose faith in me I never doubted." It is most appropriate that he is called upon to conclude this day of celebration of Rav Soloveitchik's contributions, because not only does he head Yeshiva University, but because he himself is a student of the Rav and so much a product of and an advocate for all for which the Rav stands. As Rabbi Lamb states in the introduction to his book, Torah Lishma, quote, "I was granted the privilege of studying at the foot of a giant of Jewish law and spirit, Rabbi Joseph Ber Soloveitchik, is the Rav Mukhak of my adult years. I had the privilege of studying under him when I was a student at Reach, and I have considered him my master ever since. It was he who sponsored my dissertation, and it is thus he who awarded me both my Sira and my Doctor of Philosophy degree. His illustrious personality and genius graces our generation. The Rav and all of Klal Yisrael are well served by this student. It is my privilege to call upon Dr. Norman Lamb.
In the third question, you're speaking about God revealing himself to him. And in the middle is a story about a nursemaid. Second, why all this crying? Ain Bechiva Anaka Alhamenekata Feda. An old lady, a nurse, no more. Why this tubby cry? Yes, a certain amount of crying is decorous and understandable. But to call the name of the place Alon Bachus and to warrant the special pasuk of the Torah, what's happening here? Without answers. When Yaakov built the Mizbeach, he brought a carbon. We are not told of any special emotional participation by Yaakov. It was the Mizbeach, it was the carbon. Nothing special is told of us, to us, about Yaakov's feelings, what he did and what he said. There was no special mention of gratitude by Yaakov having finished with the dreadful story of Shem and Dinah. And therefore, there was no response by the Kohen Gadol. There was no Gilui Shchina, no revelation. But then, when Yaakov Avinu busied himself personally with the burial of his mother's old nursemaid, and he called the name of the place Alon Bachus to memorialize, that was different. Because there, Yaakov Avinu was saying, this old lady was the one who made my mother who she was. If not for her, who knows what might have happened to Rivka, the daughter of Bethuel and the sister of Laban. And if she wouldn't have been trained the way she was by Zipporah Hermeneges, who knows if she ever would have married my father Yitzchak, and I certainly wouldn't be in this world. She was my mother's Rebbe. If you will, she was my mother's Rosh Yeshiva. I order her this. This is my gratitude to her. And when Yaakov Avinu finally reached the Madrega of the level of being able to give gratitude with a full heart, then by later on the king Yaakov, then there was Gilui Shchina. Not for the Mizbeach and the Korban, but Gilui Shchina for a man who knew how to appreciate an old and otherwise unremarkable lady insofar as the world was concerned. And therefore, this evening, this whole day, has been one of Hakaras HaTov to our Rebbe. And I compliment the Orthodox Union, I really do, for the insight, the sensitivity to take this event, this year, this convention, and dedicate it to the 50th year of the Rav's teaching at Yeshiva University. I acknowledge personally my endless gratitude to Rabbi Soloveitchik, as my Rebbe, as my Masna, my doctoral sponsor, and since I've come to Yeshiva, my mentor at every step until illness took him away from Yeshiva. And let me tell you something about Yeshiva. Yeshiva, all of the Yeshivas of Yom Tov is molded in his image and on his pattern. He remains the preeminent role model to which all of the yeshiva students aspire. Indeed, he is Yeshiva University. He is the spirit, the finest spirit of Yeshiva University. And I must tell you about his loyalty to Yeshiva. I understand that Julius Berman in his introducing this morning, this afternoon session, told you about an event where he spoke on behalf of Yeshiva. That was the second time that happened, upon my request. The first time, we were in the depths of despair, insofar as the Jew was allowed to despair. We were in the very lowest point that Yeshiva University ever was, except maybe 100 years ago when it was just beginning. And I asked the Rav to participate in something, and I told him my plan, and he agreed. What I did was, I called an emergency board meeting in the office of our then chairman of the board, Herman Henson, for whose health we pray. And all the very important, distinguished laymen who formed the board of Yeshiva were there. And I carried on a conversation with them, discussing the problems we had, and did not tell them what was going to happen. And then suddenly, the secretary of his attendant came in with a message, "You have a visitor whom Dr. Lamb told me he expects. May I show him in?" Herbert Henson said to me, "Do you know anything about this?" I said, "Yes." Didn't tell him what. And in walked the Lord. You can imagine the transformation that took place in that room. It was stunning. And the Lord sat down, and as I said today, I think by Rabbi Lichtenstein, he always prepared his remarks, always. He took out of his pocket a folded paper and began to read his remarks, and he moved everyone's ears. It was an expression of gratitude to Yeshiva for what Yeshiva had done for him. I was moved because my impression was always that it was a one-way street. Yeshiva is so enormously grateful for the Lord. But he turned it around. He said that Yeshiva gave him a platform he otherwise might never have had. He told him how Yeshiva had meant so much to his children, his sons-in-law, his sons, how very much it had meant for him and for his brothers. How much the whole outlook of Yeshiva accorded and resonated with his own. And therefore, he was there to ask them to do what it's like. I must tell you, he then left the room, and that marked the beginning of the redemption of Yeshiva University from its displacement to horrendous and impossible death. So the Rav, in a wild effort, played a critical role in the saving of Yeshiva in 1979. It was exactly about 5, 6, 7, 8 months later that we were able to hand a check of $35 million to the bank to save Yeshiva. So this evening, as a gesture of gratitude, permit me to speak of the Lord in the way that I will invest. As a letter, as a Rosh Yeshiva, an educator, or as he likes to call himself, a kind of delicious affectation, first started by his great-great-great-grandfather, the Frank Kolozhina, I'm a Lamed. And I find it manifested in 6 different aspects of his magisterial career, of his teaching career. I hope all of you are compassionate people and have a great deal of compassion and sympathy for me, having to speak about the Rav after hearing Rabbi Persky and Rabbi Lichtenstein. If I repeat anything, number one, I trust in your power of forgetfulness. Number two, Dr. Samuel Johnson used to say, it's not so much important to instruct people as it is to remind them. And if we repeat something on the positive of the Rav, it's worth hearing again. First and above all else, the Rav was an Isha Emes, a man of truth. Whether in halakha or philosophy or communal life, he despised shyness and shallowness. He was merciless to students who were thoughtless. I must tell you, he was a terror in class. The later year students who were there saw a wonderful, sweet man in his later years. They don't know what he was when he was a young man in his 40s, early 50s. He used to give a shiur every Tuesday and Wednesday from 1 to 3. The first shiur that I came to was a Tuesday. That was the last time in many years that I ate lunch on Tuesday and Wednesday. I never trusted myself to eat lunch again. He came into class and he saw power. Intimidation, unintended, but his very presence, the sheer brilliance. To see him, the architectonics and the sheer greatness of analysis of the law and the text of Gemara was enough to make you feel that you were standing present in massive gracious. If we were present in massive gracious, wouldn't we be overwhelmed? Well, this was creativity, raw creativity. And the Rav never allowed a student to be unprepared. If you were unprepared, you didn't come to class. And he was pitiless if you were mindless or thoughtless or said narishkeit, superficial. Like the Rambam, who in his introduction to the Moreh Nebuchim says, I prefer to satisfy one intelligent man and to displease 10,000 fools. The Rav never suffered fools gladly. He was impatient with artificiality. He did not aim to please. In his policy, communal policy, in his learning, and in his theology, his machshava, machshavat Yisrael, He never played with the gallows. So the great Malaskaris, the author of the Torah Sanhedrin, who came to his contemporary, the Gadol Yisrael at that time, the Hassan Sofer, and he said to Rabbi, I want to publish a sefer, I want your Haskalah, but I'm rather apprehensive, because I'm afraid that people will say there's no chiddush, there's no originality, what's my contribution, and they'll laugh at me. The Hassan Sofer said, don't worry, you go ahead and publish it. Let me tell you something. The Gemara says in Beitza of the Flamen Fest, that Rabbi Abba, before he went up from Babel to Eretz Yisrael, offered a special tefillah. And the tefillah that he offered was Yehi Ratzon She'omar Dovar HaMiskabel Al Da'atam She'chach Me'Eretz Yisrael. When I come to Eretz Yisrael, the goal of the Mishpedesh, then I pray you, Rabbi Shalom, make it so that I should say what is acceptable to the Chach Me'Eretz Yisrael, they should approve of what I said. He offered a prayer, and apparently it didn't do much good. But the Gemara said that he came to Eretz Yisrael, they came to me and Lord go along, they mocked him, they ridiculed him. Now I understand that, says the Hassan Sofer, but I don't understand is another Gemara compared to this. The Gemara says in Rochis of Lachesh, the famous Gemara, that Rabbi Nechunya ben Harkona, when he came into the Beis Medrash, he used to offer a special prayer. The prayer was, the Yerotzai may be the will of God, so Yikasheo b'zvah halacha, I should not fail in my Dvar Halacha. The Yisrachu b'chaverai and my colleagues should provide pleasure for me. And we hear no place that his prayer failed. We don't read that he was blogged over, that they ridiculed him, they mocked him. Why did Abi Abba, despite his prayer, inherit this terrible ridicule, whereas Rabbi Chunya ben Hakona did not? The answer is this. Rabbi Abba said, Yehirosam, my prayer is, She'omar dovar she'yiskaber al-daas hachmeyes Yisrael, a wonderful favor in their eyes. If all you want to do is please somebody else, you're not going to succeed. Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakona, first, his emphasis was not on pleasing anybody, but on involving questions about halakha, what I say should conform to the halakhic truth, it should be a bar emes. And second, not that they should accept what I say, but yisrach will be a bar emes. They should like me as a friend, they should be happy with me. And that's why his feel was accepted. The Rav never tried to satisfy other Rambanim, other Rosh Yeshivas, Talmidim, Zazayim. He pursued the truth relentlessly, and he taught us to pursue emes in our learning as well. Since this afternoon we were talking about the Rizka Derech, permit me to tell you something that I heard from the Rav that enormously impressed me. As you know by now, the Rav is the greatest progenitor, the greatest advocate and practitioner of Rizka Torah, of the kind of methodology in Talmud that was originated by his grandfather, the Chaim Soloveitchik of Chaim Rizka's Torah. But the Rav said very often, the dichotomy, the Shnei Dinim, that a concept can be broken up into two constituent parts, develops to a kind of sacred vocabulary, which people later repeat, but has no real meaning. Chetzet Gavrim, Maaseh Mitzvah, Kiyumah Mitzvah, all the various distinctions that the Chaim popularized. After a while, they became so popular that young Talmidim used to have their own Chidushim by simply using this terminology. How can you tell when it's real? And how can you tell when it's spurious, when it's not real? And he said very simply, try to say the same thing in English. If you can say the same thing in English and it makes sense, then you're not playing around with terminology. It's not a nomenclature game. If you cannot translate it into English, you know you're playing with words and not with real concepts. I found that has helped me very often. So this element of Bakrashasa and this, the pursuit of truth, leads to the second thing. And that is the Rav's remarkable independence in thinking and in living, in intellect and in experience. That is revealed throughout his career in his striking originality. In both Halacha and Amar Shoma, he had one might almost say, frequently had the boldness of Elisha. The precursors, in this sense, were his great-grandfather, the Chaim Volozhiner, who always maintained that you have to go according to the Gemara before you look at a Shulchan Aruch. And if he found it necessary to disagree with some of the Nosei Kelim of the Shulchan Aruch, which after all is the standard code for Jews, then you do it if this follows your own independent thought as you pursue the truth of Halacha. He said even a student can teach you something, just as a small stick can be used to kindle a great fire. A young student who has a straight mind and the emphasis on Tora Yeshara, on straight thinking, Nishmakrum, not devious, but straight, clear, intellectual thinking and analysis. This is what characterized probably his two greatest heroes among the Nishonim, the Rambam and the Ramban, the Vilna Gaon, his great great grandfather, the Chaim, and of course, his grandfather, the Chaim Rifkin. The Lord, who was so independent, it revealed itself in all aspects of his personality. He was independent in the way he dressed. He never dressed like the stereotype of a Rosh Yeshiva, didn't find it necessary. Besides, he always disliked uniforms. He did not try to conform to anyone in his demeanor. And, language. Spoke three languages to us. I heard him speak at the beginning, he used to Yiddish, so you were in Yiddish. Then he switched over to English as the rest of his students understood Mabalashim. And of course, every now and then in Hebrew. And each language was pure. His Yiddish was Yiddish, a literary Yiddish. His English, despite the Lithuanian accent, was a better English than 99.9% of his American-born students. And his English was English. And his Hebrew was Hebrew. He never vowelized them. He never mixed them up. He never thought that English is a sign of genuine Yerushalayim. I sometimes plead with my students, for heaven's sake, I'm a simpleton. Speak to me either English. That's a nerve. It can be either English, or Hebrew, or Yiddish. But mamish, you don't have to always ask the show to say, oh no, I'm glad to see I'm not the only one who said this. This originality, this independence, this superb analytic gift of the love and pursuit of truth earned him vast respect. But I must tell you, it also earned him some hostile critics. Some hostile critics to this very day. Even, or perhaps especially, those who shamelessly repeat his Torah without having the decency to mention his name. So his example as an independent thinker has become a shining light for his students. Third, as a teacher, the Lord tried to stretch our minds and make us think for ourselves. His whole career, I see as a gesture of protest and rejection against what I believe is George Orwell first coined the term group thinking, thinking as if you're in a flock, as if you had to follow everybody else, and the inability to think for yourself and by yourself. He interpreted the Maamar Chazal in Pirkei Avos, Ha'amidu Talmidim Harbei, not as an injunction to raise up many students, because that would have said, Ha'amidu Harbei Talmidim. But Ha'amidu Talmidim Harbei means the emphasis on the first word, Ha'amidu Talmidim Harbei. A teacher is supposed to make a student think for himself, stand on his own feet. Not to be always reliant upon the other. He wanted us to think for our own selves. And I must tell you that I have a scar to prove it. It was my first year in the Gutenberg class. We were learning voice concept for about a week and a half. Tishi Rubin was developing one idea in a paper, trying to formulate as far as basis. Following day, Wednesday, I come into class with the others, and we all cower around our Gemaras. He looks up, he says, Lam! He says, what's the Pshat Pesis? What does he mean? What does Pesis? Gave him back everything he said, exactly the way he said it. And he stopped, and he turned furious. He says, Lam, they can sell you the Brooklyn Bridge! The trouble with you is, when you come in, you're checking your Sahara outside the door, you're coming with your Yetzer Hara. Forget about your Yetzer Hara, bring your Yetzer Hara in. But please went on and on and on. I said what you said. He said, but I know what I said already. I want to know, what do you say? How are you thinking it through? For me, that was the most important shiur I ever heard from the Lord. Because that dressing down, that scolding, taught me that even from the Rav, the once in my life, the greatest man I ever met, you don't accept things merely on authority, but rather you think for yourself. Remember the cartoon I once saw in the New Yorker of a little boy coming home with his books from kindergarten, and his mother said, what did you do today in school, dear? And he said, with a grim face, today we learned how to think. It hurt. Forced us onto the path of our individual creativity in the pursuit of truth. Fourth, the Rav as a teacher, as a person of course as well, had this enormous breadth, this scope, this universal sweep. He used all knowledge in order to attain what he considered the truth. All knowledge. Sacred knowledge, how I was overwhelmed by his mastery of Halacha and Akkadah and Kabbalah and Chassidus and Machshavas Yisrael and medieval Jewish philosophy, and his mastery of the sacred, of his secular realm, of Plato and Aristotle and Kant, whom he mentioned so frequently, of formal logic and mathematical logic and literature and history. I shall never forget the first time how shocked I was, and later inspired, when he quoted, of all people, Augustine, one of the church fathers. Nowadays, it rolls off our lips amongst those of us who are talking and very lightly. Today, Rabbi Lipson being quoted Aquinas, another church dignitary, one of the great philosophers. When I heard the law, by Dr. Shiva speaking of that, I couldn't believe it. Then later, I realized that he was following in a great tradition. Rav Haizan, when he didn't know the meaning of a Apostolica in Tanakh, sent out his Talmud, who was then the Dayan of Baghdad, to go to the local Catholic bishop who was a Munche in Tanakh and ask his charge. Yes. And the Abarbanel and Shokin quotes Rashi, and then Mahapali quotes the Archbishop of Canterbury and prefers the letter. That didn't work through. The Rambam and the Shmona Krokin says, and he knew why, we know why he was saying it. Don't worry if I happen to build my theory based upon the thinking of certain philosophers who are not Jewish, because, and this actually is a verse in Ben Sira, Shema es ha-emes mimisha amaro, receive the truth, emes, no matter who said it. The truth can be uttered by anyone, but it has to be true. And if you accept it, then you grow. So this scope, this enormous scope, was enough to inspire, educate, and enlighten his students. Talmud says the Shabbos, Maritza the Shabbos, the difference between MS and Sheker, truth and falsehood. Sheker is narrow because it contains three letters that follow each other. Kuf, Bei, Shin. So change the order and you have Sheker. MS, Aleph is the first letter of the alphabet, Mem is someplace in the middle, Kuf is the end. You've got to have breadth, because if you have only a narrow focus, then you have tunnel vision and a distorted truth. This is the breadth that we learn from the Lord. And fifth, and very important, intellectual honesty. Permit me to tell you another story or two, because sometimes my Sarah can tell you much more than my own poor words can relate. It was my second year of the Rav's class. We were learning the Sefer Shabbos. He he had been developing over a very long time one salient point of Upanishad. Very profound. The beginning of the Tuesday Shir, about a half an hour into the Shir, the youngest student in class, a very brave young man, the rest of us were cowering, it never bothered him, said, "Really, the Kedusha Adam disagrees with you." So I said, "What? What did he say?" And he said what the Kedusha Adam said. And we stood up, suddenly put his hands down, his face in his hands, his elbows on the table, and dead silence that lasted for about 3 or 4 minutes and felt like an hour. The class was absolutely silent. Then he took from his breast pocket his notes that were folded this way, which shocked me. I always thought that all this was going on in the course of dialogue with you, Rebbe, and tell me that the Shiva was being created. That's how marvelous a teacher he was. No, it was all prepared. He took out his pencil, and page after page, he etched out one after the other, one after the other. And this was the clue of the Hiskalism of the Revelation. How many other Rashi Yeshiva would have seen so quickly to what a youngest Talmud Kalman in the class said? Would have actually taken out his notes and tossed it off, and then he said, "Forget everything that I said, it's all Havel Hamalim," and he walked out of class. That was the end of a 2.5 hour shiur. Last half an hour did that day. That's intellectual honesty, that's integrity. Of course, there's a follow up to the story. The next day he came in with a grin from ear to ear, and he had to say, he said, "Shulman, now read it and tell me what it says." Of course, he was right, and Shulman was wrong. I'm going to tell you another story that I've not ever mentioned publicly. It's an important one, and I'm not going to give you the detail. Just those parts are relevant to what I'm saying. Tonight, that's the space is laid. And that is the earth site, both of Gavar and Kutla, the Kasabi Kablocha, and the founder of Yeshiva University, Bernard Rebel, the Kasabi Kablocha. So it's appropriate to tell you something about how Rav Kutla related to the Yeshiva, and especially Mahatma Mechayim Mechayim Kudalot. It had to do with a problem that was affecting all Jews who live in the heavens. I was then the Rav of the Jewish Center on West 86th Street. And I told the Rav I had to speak to him, I had an important problem. I met with him, I said, "Rebbe, this and this is the Indian, and I'd like to know if I can go ahead on it." He said, "I don't know, I don't know those halachas." I said, "Rebbe, you don't know those halachas." He said, "I don't know, I haven't learned it in a long time." No pretense, he wasn't showing I need this. Being honest with me, of course, any day I would exchange everything I know what he didn't know in that one area. But he said, "I can't possibly say to you, have you got into this one yet?" I said, "Yes." He said, "What I do learn to, I told the son that I went to. So what do you have to bother me? Ask him." And even though you may later decide that I'm wrong, so what? This is your Kehillah, it's your community, you've gone through it, ask him. And I asked him. Later there was a whole imbroglio, a whole kalalam, as they say in Israel, about the gun, with the Rabbonim, other Rabbonim, who disagreed with what we had done. And they called down the Bar and Kutla to a meeting of the Akudas of Rabbonim, which I was summoned, unbeknownst to what I was coming to. And there they, Kutla read a Medissa. Before he stopped, I said to Rebbe, "I must tell you that if you say so, I'll follow you, but I want you to know the consequences. Not for a curling in the light, and not for Yeshiva Bokhram, but for my mother body." And I told him what I thought, and I said, "And therefore, the 120 year when we come before the Beis and Shalmala, I want you to know I am not responsible for my mother body, but the Kutka of Yeshiva that covered it." And I walked out. The next day he called me. I received a call that they were putting on film in my shul. And he asked me to come to see him, and I came to see him together with then Rabbi Jacobowitz, now Lord Jacobowitz. And we visited him, and he said, "What are you doing, and why are you doing it?" And I said, "Rebbe, do you have any halakhic objections?" He said, "To tell you the truth, I don't know. I never learned these trivia as well." I was stunned, because I saw again how the passion for truth allows a man of such eminent stature to say, "Well, you're not, I don't know." Lesser people would never admit that they don't know. They foster the myth, which no one believes in anyway, that they know everything. But Gedolim could say, "I don't know." So I saw again a kesher of pursuit of truth. There's only one difference. Only one difference. The significant one. The Rav said, "I don't know," and encouraged me to think and act for myself. The Baron said, "I don't know," and insisted that nothing be done without his authority. Two different personality types, two hashkafas, two approaches. But for the Rav, the encouragement of independence and the pursuit of emes with honesty was a major thing. And finally, despite the fact that the face that I saw of the Lord during the times of the chagrin of many years, that I was, you know, saved by him on your door, that I was his disciple, I hope that that never ends, and never did end. Despite the stern liam, the strict classroom procedure, that single-minded, relentless pursuit of truth, that intimidating presence, he was and is an Ish Chesed, who combined an old-world charm with a kind of Bostonian class, all of it fermented with the yeast of his own inimitable personality. What a courteous man. Not only towards Zabonim, but when you were in his home in Boston, even in his mother's apartment on West 186th Street, 7th Street, or in his apartment at Yeshivas, if you saw him there, he would ride, walking from the door. His courtesy to women, his courtesy to strangers. He had great kindness, a very sympathetic human being, in the Baal Tzedakah. And when he occasionally allowed us a glimpse into his inner life, his private experience, we saw Chesed suffusing his entire neshama. Powering intellect that he was when it came to halachic objectivity, he was balanced by a sensitive subjectivity in both his heart and in his mind, his din and in his chesed. Both were penetrated by the judgment of the Salavatian genius. Such are the components, only some, of his towering magisterial personality. Personality which has fascinated, enthralled, inspired, ennobled Yeshiva University since 50 years ago, when the Kadosh Baruch Hu blessed us all with his presence as our Rosh Yeshiva. I began, my friends, with an expression of the Kadosh Baruch Hu. I shall conclude with the same. All of us, the entire community, are deeply indebted to him. I remember him complaining once, I don't recall if it was in a address or a shiur to me personally. He said, "What if anyone thinks that comes to the Shoniyam Kippur, sending me a New Year's card, a Karakas for Rosh Hashanah?" It suddenly struck me how much for granted we took him. Everything we took for granted. And how guilty I feel, probably all of Kamina were in the same way. When he gave a particularly great cheer, who would ever think of going up to the Lord and saying thank you? Never. We thought that he was created for our sake. Called Leila Lodibra Lashem Shlemi. What an insensitive attitude he took. My children would take their parents for granted. So I know that I speak for myself and probably for all his other students. He took him for granted too much. We never said thank you. How I wish you were here tonight to be our guest. Not because of praise, he wasn't impressed by that. He was so unimpressed by pretense and even by genuine praise. He didn't need it. His personality didn't need it. But appreciation, yes. Appreciation that what he had to teach was being received, taken seriously, thought about, studied, and put into practice. The knowledge that his disciples and his community have been impacted, changed by his teaching, their lives altered, ennobled, and given with a bit more transcendent meaning. We are here in order to say, Him, were He here tonight? Thank you, Rebbe, for all you did and meant to us, and our parents, and our children and grandchildren, for generations to come. Forgive us if we take you for granted. Thank you for being our guide for half a century, for showing us a derech in learning and in life, for the privilege of sitting at your feet, the greatest Baal Masbir I have ever known, for the sheer aesthetic, almost hedonistic pleasure of your scintillating, no other word will do, fascinating, passionate, illuminating darkness in which you show your power as a gong, as a thinker, and as an architect of thought and rhetoric. For teaching us to pursue the truth, to shun what is sham, to think for ourselves as London should, for stretching our minds and for imbuing our hearts with chesed, for trying to keep us intellectually honest, for expanding our heart into us, our intellectual and spiritual father. And so we, your Talmidim, and your children, most earnestly pray that the Rabbana Shalom watch over you, guide you in your old age, and give you health and the poor. And that would be a bit so I just have one last as far as the day. We owe so much as his disciples and as his children, but none of us can do very much about his condition right now. But there are two people who do. and tender, loving, reverend care, a marvelous, incredible display of people's confidence. We are grateful to them for doing what is really the task of all of us. We shall lay Hashem for the love, the esteem, and the confidence we want in Hashem for the day's service.